Thank you so much, Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org, founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy.
We are on the air. We're actually going off the air. At least I am. Labor Hour's here. Thanks for listening. That was Sonali Kalhatar of Uprising Radio there from the joint Upfront morning show out on the left coast with Norman Solomon, who's got a recent article. I guess that was from Wednesday on Common Dreams and most of the other portals. Norman Solomon, incisive, as you hear. And another thing about Bill Keller that we should remember when we're thinking about the critique of him in his obituary of Obama that you can find at fair.org. Counterspin, a product of Fair. So, time to kick it off. Mandela, I'm sorry.
Well, I had me a job down at the local mill. Work dried up.
Just not working anymore. They used to call us working class. Hello, folks, and welcome to the December 7th edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming on the internet at weft.org. Thanks to everybody for tuning in today, and let you know the views and opinions expressed during this hour of programming are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, Prairie Air Incorporated, associates, or anybody else. It's just us speakers. Now here's Bill with some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information, or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217-328-2295. That's 328-2295. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Want to go for another one, Bob?
Yeah, let's do three. Okay.
They're not too bored yet, huh?
Not yet.
Programming on the World Labor Hours is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the Illinois Education Association Union. The Illinois Education Association's mission is to effect excellence and equity in public education and to be the, that's emphasis that they put there,
that's
the.
Capitals, all caps.
That's right, all
shouting.
Caps. Right, yelling
T-A-G.
At you. The advocacy organization for all.
We hit the red on that one, Bill.
Public education employees. Sorry to distort. Please excuse my distortion. My overmodulation.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll get the other two later.
We'll do Bill and the GEO later.
All right. Sounds good. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today with Bill Gorell. We're hoping to have Dr. Robert Boone in here in a little while, continuing on our conversation about healthcare issues in the country these days. Anyway, we'll get into some news stories here. I got a news story I took off of Illinois Times. In These Times, it's by David Moberg, and it talks about the unions being furious with Illinois Democrats over the pension cuts. It says here, Illinois legislators facing the deepest pension funding shortfall of any state, a gap of over $100 billion and growing, voted on Tuesday to fill the hole by cutting $160 billion over the next 30 years in pension payments that the state had promised to current and future state employees. The decision by the solidly Democratic state government strongly rebuffed the public employee unions that played a major role in winning and holding a Democratic majority for the past decade. Governor Pat Quinn, a Democrat, called it a victory for taxpayers and implicitly for himself and pledged to sign it. But in fact, Quinn, an advocate of pension reform, without a specific proposal, played a minor role. The bill was crafted almost entirely by the powerful Speaker of the Illinois House, Democrat Michael Madigan of Chicago, who fought off other proposals from legislators in both parties. Last weekend, the top leaders in the House and Senate from both parties approved the final legislation with only modest revisions to Madigan's original bill. Among other changes in state pension plans, it cuts cost of living adjustments, raises the retirement age, opens the door to defined contribution or 401k style plans that could weaken current plan funding and increase workers' financial risk. So all kinds of good things for the pensions, I guess, if you're looking at it from Quinn's point of view. Earlier this year, Madigan refused to allow the House to vote on an alternative pension reform bill introduced by Senate President John Cullerton, a Democrat, which the Senate had approved. Cullerton's plan, fashioned in negotiations with public employee unions would have saved the state even more money than Madigan's proposal, but it would have protected more of the contractual benefits of public employees. Under that plan, public employee unions first gave their members a choice. They could keep either their pension or medical benefits as they had been, then accept cuts in the other benefit plan. That's what the state of Illinois did to the people that are either working for them or have worked for them for 30 and 40 years.
I was just wondering how Quinn's and the legislatures, how their pensions are doing, their pension plans. Are they fully funded?
I would imagine they are, Bill.
They might have taken care of that. The state of Illinois, I believe, does have a clause in its constitution that says that these pensions are basically kind of sacrosanct and that they will be paid. Unfortunately, apparently, they also needed a clause in the constitution that would force the legislature and the government to actually pay into the plan.
Yes.
I think they just assumed, well, yeah, if they have to pay it, they'll pay into the plan. I don't know.
Because they haven't been paying, and that's been the big problem for, 30 years or so, maybe longer.
Right, and that constitution was written in 1970.
Yeah, we had a constitutional what was that?
Convention.
Constitutional Convention in the state of Illinois.
I was in seventh grade, I remember.
Yeah.
I believe.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to make much difference because, you know, in Detroit, they just declared bankruptcy and they're throwing all of their pensions up in the air, too. So, you know, I suppose the state of Illinois, well, you can't declare bankruptcy as a state, can you?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, I think you would have to be able to declare bankruptcy as a state because a state can't print its own money.
Yeah.
See, the United States never... I don't want to go off on a great big modern monetary theory explanation right now, but don't ever worry about the national debt.
Okay? Right.
We're a sovereign nation.
Right.
We can print our own money.
We can print as much money as we need.
That's right. And apparently we need a lot more because, well, no, it's... Yeah. Go on, Bob. You got stories.
Okay. I'll go on to a different one here. This is something Dave sent to me this week. Ohioans elect 24 city councilors on independent labor ticket. This was earlier this week. After one too many sellouts by the local Democratic Party, the Lorain County Central Labor Council decided to draw a line in the sand and run their own city council candidates on an independent Labor Party ticket. 24 won seats, including union teacher Joshua Thornsberry. Union-dense Lorain County, Ohio, is now home to an independent labor slate of 24 newly elected city councilors, recruited and run by the Central Labor Council there. All labor's candidates had strong showings last month, and all but two were elected. It says here, "This was a step we took reluctantly," said Lorain County AFL-CIO President Harry Williamson. "When the leaders of the Democratic Party just took us for granted and tried to roll over the rights of working people here, we had to stand up." A series of disputes between organized labor and the Democratic leadership led the Labor Council and its allies to recruit and run their own slate in this Democratic stronghold, home of Ohio's largest steel and auto facilities. The unions had worked for years to build a labor-community partnership that resulted in a Lorain City Project Labor Agreement, a PLA, which required that city contracts be staffed by at least 75% local and 9% minority workers and unionized during the period of the project. But Mayor Chase Rittenour pushed the city council to repeal it. "It took us 3 years to negotiate this historic agreement," said Joe Thayer, marketing director of the Sheet Metal Workers Union, "and it took them 3 days to kill it. The city council voted 8-2 in favor of the repeal. It was reported that an estimated $29.6 million in city road and water projects were soon to be awarded." They went on to put up the labor council decided to run its own slate of 24 candidates, mostly union members, for city council seats in the towns of Lorain, Amherst, Avon, and Avon Lake. The union crowd at the council meeting, some in independent Labor Party shirts, the council had ordered for the campaign, greeted the victorious candidates with loud cheers and optimism. The council has ordered more shirts to supplement the 500 used during the campaign. Says, we didn't pick this fight, but we had to finish it, said Thayer. We need to build stronger alliances, work with more friends, even if we put our issues on a back burner to help and fight for our friends in the communities. We need to keep reaching out and show that our interests are the same as others. If we do that, then we'll grow. So, interesting stuff there in Lorain County.
Too bad it's a rare event. It really should have been the standard for several, at least since the Depression. It's one thing not to have a labor party.
Right.
But why not have more labor people running,
Right.
For offices.
You followed that more than I have about the labor party that was more active up in Chicago like 20 years ago and stuff. And you've mentioned several times on the show in the last few months about, whatever happened to it and why isn't it more active and involved?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I joined the Labor Party Advocates. That was actually an organization before the Labor Party got started. And Peter Miller went to the convention. Founding convention of the Labor Party.
So that was 15 years ago then?
Oh, it was back in the 90s, yeah. Huh. Maybe around 97, something like that. Yeah, I think I'd already been into this for maybe a little bit.
Into this?
Yeah, into
WEFT and the World Labor Hour?
Yeah, and the more labor thing. I never, even though for about my first 20 years as a union member, largely, I guess, because I was a member of Labor's Local 703, and at the time there wasn't really, much labor movement idea there. It was more like mafia movement.
Mm-hmm.
But and I never really thought much about labor issues. I really didn't. I my idea of union people actually came from the late 60s and early 70s when I saw people in hard hats on TV beating up peace protesters.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And then I got, went to Decatur just to take pictures. And we do have a guest.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Robert Boone is coming in the studio here. So, but that was you went to Decatur to take pictures, Bill.
Eh? Yeah, I was going to build up my photojournalistic portfolio, and got pretty involved. Met Ann Feeney.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting names, but actually, most of my really good friends now that don't stem from childhood come from out of that situation, one way or another.
Yeah.
And Dr. Boone, how are you today,
good morning,
sir?
I'm doing pretty well. It's chilly.
Yeah, it is chilly out there.
And a little late, I apologize.
No, that's fine.
No, we usually try to get our guests on about 11:30, actually, so we're kind of going through some labor news stories here.
Yeah, I heard you talking about some peace marches.
I just remember when I was like in grade junior high school or something, mm-hmm. I just remember all these guys in hard hats beating up hippies and whatever, and they were real hostile. And I just didn't, my union to me was just a place where I got jobs,
These guys in hard hats weren't police. These were labor
union
thugs.
Yeah, and I wasn't aware of this specifically, but when the farm workers were trying to organize in the 60s, the Teamsters would go in and sign sweetheart contracts with the growers and then have Teamster thugs beating the union organizers.
That here locally or out in California?
No, that was out west. Yeah. Mainly California, I'm sure. But I, there was the unions movement was pretty, except for a few people like Walter Reuther and so on. It was, it's always been, and unfortunately, it quite often reflects its membership.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. Like, it depends if those unions were teachers or.
Right.
Or whether or not they were construction workers, or were they road workers, or people who were more or less, they were different type of people. So they were protecting their interests.
Yeah, that's true. And because of the lack of class consciousness so much in the United States, and the whipsawing between black and white workers, over the years, how many stories in Illinois are there of coal mine strikes.
Right.
I mean, specifically Pena.
Yeah.
You know, and black strike, or black workers.
Where they would bring in workers, right. Trains and stuff. Right.
Thought they were just going to get a job. They end up being thrown out of a second story window with a sheet tied around their neck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, if you study anything about Mother Jones, that was going on quite frequently in those days where they were bringing in people on trains to break the strikes and work the scabs.
The movie Matawan is first they bring in the Italians, mm-hmm. you know, then the Italians join the strikers, then they bring in the black scabs, and then... I love this scene so much. Have you seen this?
No, I've never seen it. I'll have to watch it, though.
Well, you know, James Earl Jones is basically kind of God in a lot of ways. And there's this one scene where he's sort of the de facto leader of the black group. And they decide that they've had it with the coal mine. And he has this shovel. And he's talking to the foreman. He goes, "I believe this is your shovel." Yeah. Hands it to him. He's just got that. It's just killer. That's a great movie.
Yeah. When did that come out, Bill?
Oh, that was in, what was that, the mid-90s? Oh, wait a minute. I'm hooked up here.
You can check it out.
That's right.
Yeah. You know,
and that's M-A-T-E-W-A-N.
M-A-T-E-W-A-N. How about if we go to a quick little musical break here? You know, Ball had a lot of stuff on his show about minimum wages and... you know, some of the income inequality in this country. And so Bill went and grabbed a CD off the back shelves there from David Rovics. So we're going to listen to a tune here, Minimum Wage Strike.
Yeah, so. It's interesting. They're just catching up. They've been talking about guaranteeing annual income for 100 years.
Yeah.
Since President Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to have come back. You know, I mean, Richard Nixon was for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Martin Luther King, and
cost of living thing probably happened under Nixon, right?
Yeah.
Well, actually, probably wages and all social benefits were probably the Nixon administration would have been the peak in America at that time. It's been like leveled out flat or going down since.
I think I saw pretty something much. As I was looking at this minimum wage, and they say adjusted for inflation, the peak was in 1968. And that was approximately, in today's adjusted wages, that was about 10 and a quarter an hour.
Exactly.
And since then, it's basically been going down.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and,
and in 19, that was $1.60 an hour.
Back
which,
then, right.
Which I know stayed that way and for at least 5 years because I worked at Collegiate Cap and Gown in the cap laundry.
That was in my high that was in my high school years there, too. Early 70s, like
you used
that.
To work
you know?
Rush?
I wasn't that collegiate cap. I was working for minimum wage up in Chicago, Bill.
Oh, somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay.
But,
yeah, that place is something else, man.
Yeah.
I remember in 65, it was like $1.25.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because that's what we got when I started a part-time job. It was one of those government kind of jobs where they hired youths during the summer.
Yeah.
It was $1.25.
Wow.
Man. Yeah. I remember sometime, this is when I was in grade school, but matter of fact, it was before I was 10 years old because we still lived out on the farm. I remember my dad talked to my mother about back in those days we had the hired man.
Yeah.
You know, it was always called the hired man. And the hired man, my dad was talking about paying him $70 a week plus all rent, a free place to live, all utilities paid. Mm-hmm. And a side of beef every Christmas.
There you go.
And so that's what people were looking at, I'd say, probably around 1962, 63. And you know, basically all the money he got since his living expenses were pretty much covered.
Yeah.
You know, go out and buy a car.
Yeah.
Make a living.
Yeah.
Let's go to this David Rovics tune here, Minimum Wage Strike, and we'll come back and introduce our guest properly. And
get out of the nostalgia, maybe.
Yeah, because I was going to start telling stories about how much my dad paid me in grade school and stuff.
Back when the minimum wage was probably a living wage back then.
Yeah.
Closer.
Yeah.
$10.25 an hour. It doesn't quite make it now. But
yeah. All right. That's better than 7 and a quarter an hour, though. That's a lot better. You know?
Yes. So.
Anyway, David Rovics and his tune, Minimum Wage Strike.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers, all the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage, CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one flipping burgers, all the grills were cold, onion rings were in their bags, fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the truck. Corn was rotting on the stalks, no farmhands to shuck. The workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tykes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Parents were housebound, their nannies left the job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed. The Foot Locker was locked up, boss had to take a hike, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
And we're back here at WEFT on the World Labor Hour. And once again, our guest is Dr. Robert Boone, Bill Gorell, and Bob Pelesny in here. We were having an interesting discussion about Dr. King and fair wages and things like that.
And you know, I was able to go see him one time. I was 67. And it was a march in New York. He was about the war, and that's when he gave his speech about his Riverside
Beyond Church
Vietnam.
Yes.
Speech, yes. You know, and it was so many people. It was from Central Park all the way to UN Building. Nothing but people.
Wow.
Marching, standing, waiting. They had some speakers, but you could barely hear. All you know is that you were there at this march, you know, and Martin Luther King and Dr. Spock and Harry Belafonte all were there contributing, you know, and you just see the people. But along the way, there were those friendly people yelling at us, calling us communists.
Well, yes.
Calling us gay fags. calling us, you know, N-word stuff. All these things, you know, the same people. It's the same people. Different age, different time, same wordage.
Yeah. As you were saying, though, unfortunately, those people would have been some of the people that benefited the most from what Dr. King was talking about.
They just
didn't realize that he was there to help them as well.
That was what he was talking
about. Yeah, they didn't realize that the name of that march, the big march, was the Poor People's March. It was a Poor People's Campaign. All they saw was black. Or
young hippies.
Yeah. It's really is so bad. The same thing's happening now.
Right.
That's like one of my constant things that I talk about when, you know, back then, I bet if you would have asked a lot of white blue collar workers, union or not, what the biggest problem in this country was, they would have said Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what they say now? Just people on welfare. Or people on disability, you know, and I have to take a urine test
to get a job.
They should have the drug test, you know. Just,
to get their food stamps or to get their unemployment or something. Yeah.
Even though all the studies have shown the level of people using drugs when they test them down in Florida,
and Texas,
less than the national average of people using their drugs.
And how many hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars do they waste on that?
Right.
Millions. Maybe millions.
Yeah, it's probably millions. And, oh, by the way, the governor of California, his family owns a company that does
drug
testing.
Really?
Right, Bob?
Now, we were talking about that a little bit during the musical break about how employers will pit different groups against each other, you know. White against black, Hispanics against whites,
carpenters against laborers,
just to keep the various groups divided. And that was again what Dr. Boone was talking about here. Yep. One of the things that Dr. King was doing was unifying people, bringing them all together. And when he started talking more than just about the civil rights, but also about labor
rights,
issues,
labor,
union, right,
war,
yeah, right.
Yes. And also, too, like Walter Reuther. Walter Reuther would be marching with Dr. King, even though his member. Now, see, that might be a difference, too, because that's industrial unions. It seemed like the industrial people were a little bit more, you know, closer. And we're saying bad things about unions on racial things, but quite often they were the most advanced. For example, the Knights of Labor in the 19th or 18th hundreds. The 19th century, the 1800s, the Knights of Labor were they would organize women, blacks, anybody.
Hmm.
The IWW also.
Right. Sure.
And okay, we got a call. I'm gonna go out and get it.
Okay.
I
bet I can guess who it is.
Sounds good. Yeah. Hey, Bill, give them the number if they want to call in and go on the air.
Yeah, but see, we have to turn around and look and see who's actually causing the problem. It's not the fellow worker, because that fellow worker is working, he's spending money, you know, to buy goods.
He's maybe trying to put food on the table to support his family.
Maybe the goods that you're making.
Right.
So the money gets communicated, related back and forth between different groups of people.
Right.
Because you're spending money in the community.
Right.
But let's look at who's going to benefit from us doing what we're doing. They lower the wages, you know. Yeah. That's what. In fact, I think that's what this big crash was about in 2009. It was all about lowering the wages.
Yeah.
Because you lay off 25 million people and rehire them
at lower wages.
At lower wages.
Well, and actually, you know, too, that's the, like the UAW has a two-tiered wage, and so the new people that they hire are coming in at $15 an hour, what the minimum wage people want. By the way, whoever's calling right now, if you would like to talk on the air, I'm sorry I didn't get to the phone, you can call 359, what was it, Fly Live?
5483, that'll work.
Okay.
We'll turn on the ringer on that phone over there, and so we'll know if somebody does call in on that number. Hey, there we go. Let's see if we can get the caller on the air here.
Yeah. Some of this is the delusion that there's not enough stuff for everybody.
Right.
So we have to compete
right
over Right. What you visualize is there. You know, like those joke, you know, I've probably told it before, and you may have heard it, was about these three groups of people. There was an industrialist, corporate person, a conservative person, and a liberal person. And somebody leaves a plate of 12 cookies. Immediately, the corporate industrialist person takes 11 cookies and whispers in the ear of the conservative, watch out, that liberal is going to take half your cookie. So there was plenty of cookies for everybody.
Right.
You know, just like money.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of money because money should be based upon the work you do. So mm-hmm. if I do a function, I produce a product, a service, you know, there should be a reciprocal return of something for it that's going to be a living wage, as we were talking about earlier.
Right.
That there should be some reciprocalness in it. So there's plenty of work. We got roads to be built. So we got roads to be built. Somebody needs to build them. And you can pay people. That money gets related within a community so everybody prospers or does well.
All right. Why don't we see if we can put our caller on the air here. Hello, this is WEFT.
How you doing? I've been listening to your show, and I hear you talking about the laborers and the classism and all that in America. When we're talking about that, it's kind of hard for people to understand about the classism and the racism. And if we look at the classism instead of the racism, we all would be in the same boat because how the power structure is set up in America, where 1% controls more than half of the money that is, $4 trillion, less than 400 people. $2 trillion. So we got to look at how we're going to deal with the problems of America and jobs and education and stuff like that. And we can't vote the rich to take care of the poor because the rich is only taking care of the rich.
Yes, they are.
You know, that's true.
So
we talk about
the Martin Luther King issue. When he started talking about the classism, that's what really probably got him killed.
I believe you're right.
Yeah.
And there's always been this old sage that when you compare money against people, when the people are disunited, money wins. So the answer to that question is that people have to look at their interests. Now, everybody needs jobs, right? Everybody needs health care. Everybody needs schools. Everybody needs to be safe within our community. They have the sense of freedom. Not one person I know doesn't want that.
Mm-hmm.
So we realize that's what we all want, despite the fact that we may be old, young, or white or black.
It's kind of hard for me to hear you, so I'm just going to listen to you over the radio.
Okay.
Okay, thanks for the call.
No, despite who we might be, we have common interests. And if we focus on our common interests, we'll be better off. Now, 5 years ago, we started a recession, so the biggest issue was at that time was jobs. You know, so the focus should have been on creating jobs within our country. That could be just like Franklin Roosevelt did. He started out the ABC Corps things. He built bridges. He built roads. He built dams. He put people to work, and they were making a living wage. You know, we have plenty of roads now that are dilapidated, are falling apart, bridges that are unsafe.
Yes, yes.
We can devote millions of labor hours and pay people living wages, which would generate improvement in overall health of our country. The reason why we have such strife is people are worried whether or not they can pay their monthly rent, whether or not they have enough food to eat, whether or not they can get to the supermarket and back safely. Those things are all fixable issues.
Yes, yes. Talk about the income inequality and workers. You know, they had the Black Friday, you know, strikes and protests at Walmart, just trying to get a fair wage for a lot of the Walmart workers, a lot of which are on some type of public assistance. And frequently they quote about how the six heirs of the Walmart family are 10 of the richest people in this country, getting billions of dollars a year, And yet they don't seem to want to pay their workers, you know, a fair wage.
But the prices are so low.
But you can't throw, you, to the point where you can't even afford those. I use the analogy of like playing Monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all played Monopoly at some time in our life, maybe not as much as we used to. But in Monopoly, you start out with everybody has the same amount of money.
Yeah.
But the key here is not necessarily skill as to who benefits in this game. You have a dice.
Mm-hmm.
You roll a dice, and what number rolls up is simply luck. Now, by the time the game progresses, one person, as soon as you know somebody's got Park Place and Boardwalk, game over.
Yeah.
Okay? No one else in the game is gonna make it because there's too much wealth or power within that person who has, say, three or four houses or a hotel on Boardwalk and Park Place. Eventually, if you play long enough, luck, you keep rolling the dice, you're going to land on Boardwalk. $2,000. You know, you're not going to be able to afford. You're going to start selling your houses. You're going to give up all your wealth. And eventually, at the end of the game, what do they call, what do they say happens? Everybody goes bankrupt.
Yeah. Or they go to jail.
Okay, so
go directly to jail.
Or go directly to jail, you know, which may be safer than going bankrupt. I don't know.
Yeah, but speaking of the Monopoly game, created in 1933, but I believe it was actually created to expose the monopolistic tendencies of capitalism during the Depression.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
How come we didn't listen?
Yeah.
Yeah, here we go. The history of Monopoly can be traced back to 1903 when an American woman named Elizabeth or Lizzie J. Maggie Phillips created a game through which she hoped to explain the single tax theory of Henry George. Boy, that's pretty deep. It was intended as an educational tool to illustrate the negative aspects of concentrating land in private monopoly.
Wow.
Her game was called the Landlord's Game.
Hmm.
The single tax is a theory of, where you just tax land.
Hmm. Okay.
And it's, I don't want to get into it. It's really, I don't understand it that well, but I've seen a lot of people really promote only taxing land.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's, I want to, as a doctor, I was wondering, what do you think of all this uproar lately about the rollout of the ACA?
Yeah. And, that's one of the reasons we invited you on the program. You
know. Well, my opinion, I'm a single payer person. I think Medicare for everybody would be the best way to go. However, we have to get there some way or another. You know, and there's a path. Now, the rollout, you know, I'm thinking that, okay. There's some problems with. In fact, I tried to go on the site on October 1st myself. Couldn't get through. So that is a problem. But a problem only lies in the fact that it prevents people from getting the insurance that would be helpful in the first place. Not that the insurance is all that great, you know, but it prevented that from happening. So fixing that, okay, well, that's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. We've been waiting for tens of 20s and 30s and 40s of years trying to get health care for everybody. Mm-hmm. So waiting a few months probably wouldn't matter a whole lot. So that being said, there's a lot of theories about why it didn't work out right. One, there was no funds appropriated for the website. So there had to be people go and borrow money from here, there, whatever, trying to get the money to pay for an inexpensive website. But let me tell you, every place I work, we have a new computer system because of the electronic medical record issue, which is not a bad idea. 10 years ago, we talked about it, but come up with a system that works is the issue. Now, in healthcare, which the main problem with healthcare is money, all these computer systems are geared to make it easier to bill, not to help me.
Yeah. Okay, to not bill to help peers, but just to help bill people.
You know, man. So you want to come up with data because what a hospital will receive or a clinic will receive is based upon what they did, what kind of whether or not they ordered a test, mm-hmm. whether or not they did some kind of procedure, mm-hmm. whether or not they ordered a treatment. Mm-hmm. All this is in this computer system. So right. everything that you're generating into this electronic medical record is really designed toward making sure they get maximum billing.
Mm-hmm.
For my benefit, it would be something that would be geared that make it easier for me to interact with my patient and for them to understand what we're trying to do. Anything that interferes with that makes it more difficult.
Yes, yeah.
And obviously raises the cost. So all these computer systems have problems. It takes weeks and months whenever they put in a new system for me to learn it, sometimes years, in order mm-hmm. to really get a hang of making it mine.
You worked quite a while at Francis Nelson Health Center, locally?
Yes, I really enjoyed working there, 16
you still,
years.
Still work there?
No. I ceased working there about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And so now I primarily do ER work. And I like it. It's something I've been doing even while I was working in Francis Nelson.
Yeah, that's a good place, man. And that is the one good thing that I know the Jimmy John guy did was he's given like $150,000 to Francis Nelson recently, even though he doesn't want to pay any taxes in Illinois.
Yeah.
Maybe if he paid a proportionate share, a reasonable share of his income in federal and state taxes, we could have health care for people.
Well, one of the things that is not discussed a lot about the Affordable Care Act is there is monies that's allocated to improve and increase the number of community health centers within this country and also provide money for hiring doctors and providers within that system. There's a network of community health centers nationally here, and I think it's a great system. We probably do, and I still say we, we probably do better work in attending to chronically ill and low-income people than anybody,
mm-hmm.
because that's our mission.
Right.
While the mission of a for-profit institution is to make profit.
Right.
Our mission was to provide good health care. So we take pride in that.
Some of the for-profit hospitals seem to find a way to call themselves non-profit.
If they can.
Yeah.
Well, there's laws that say if they do a certain amount of charitable care that they can. Okay, so if a person comes in and they create a bill, and this bill is, say, several hundred thousand, I'll say it's only 50. And they can't pay it, and most people can't. They'll say, well, after hounding them for several years, they'll say, well, we give up, and we just call it charitable care. Mm-hmm. So now they can write that off.
Mm-hmm.
So they win either way.
So then they get tax breaks from the state?
They get tax breaks from
Well, they also don't pay property tax.
Federal government.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Urbana's usually had a big problem with Carl over the property tax issue, saying that they're not doing enough charitable care. I do have to say, though, that back in 2009 when the economy went completely to hell and I had or it was 2010, actually, a bad health problem, they did give me 75% charitable discount on my co-payments, which is probably really what it should have cost in the first place.
Yeah.
Well, why does healthcare cost so much?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That 70, it should have been probably 25% of what it was to begin with.
There's an increased cost because some people can't pay, somebody else has to pay, so they'll their cost shift. So you'll get a bill of $100,000 when it should have cost $25,000 because somebody else didn't. So they're trying to fiddle with the system, knowing that they overcharge one place and get that person who can't pay it, then now they can write it off. Little games they play.
Yeah, I don't really understand. I don't know. I tell you something that really burns me was, you know, I was born in Burnham City Hospital. You know, why? What? I never did understand that. Why did it just close up? It was owned by the city, you know, and it seemed like they gave great care. My family always used it, and heck, we lived in Bement.
You know? Yeah. Money? It wasn't generating enough money.
Hmm.
You know, a tax base decrease. So therefore, the city or county isn't able to support it.
Hmm. Man, I.
You know, we had a guest on our program a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and he was talking about the fact that at the current way that the system is set up, the federal government is actually paying for most of the highest risk people out there already.
Right.
You know, Medicare, Medicaid, and the VA. I mean, the VA, they're serving a lot of, you know, severely injured veterans.
And you know,
for physical and mental issues, they're taking care of the old. You know that where the health bills are always the highest on the old people.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know people that's gone that was surprised they ran out of their laborers insurance, and they never thought about going to the VA. They went to the VA man over in Danville, and people I talked to were just they really thought it was really good. And there's always a big idea in Congress that Republicans don't want to fund the VA because it's a too good of an example of what a government operated health care system is.
Right. Too good of an example.
Yeah, and and also if something happens bad at the VA, though, it's really blown up in the media. But you know,
but they, you know, it's underfunded to begin with,
right?
Okay, so you have to be skillful at making things work with what you have. You know, they had an old saying when I was in the service that. That we have done so much and so little, we can do just about anything with nothing.
Yeah.
You know, so at the VA, and I spent a lot of time at the VA doing my residency, and that it didn't have all the high-tech equipment. But I had one of my instructors said that, you know, when it came to technology within healthcare, there's a point of diminishing returns where technology is beneficial. Good pharmacology is beneficial, but up to a point you reach where it doesn't work anymore. In fact, it causes injury.
Hmm.
But more technology causes injury.
For example, I had a problem with an abscess in my lung. You know, that's what I was talking about with the doctor, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I was getting really worried about all of the X-rays, and I believe there were MRIs or whatever they were giving me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, this just, you know.
You know,
By the way, that new vascular institute there at Carl.
Yes.
They've got, besides what Carl already had, I know because I saw him installing these things, they've got at least two, maybe three or four giant robot arm deals for their MRIs or whatever they, CTs. I mean, these things, they're just incredible, man.
And it may be a delusion. You know, not just an illusion. It may be a delusion to the public when they see, oh, we got robotic. That sounds really futuristic. It's going to be beneficial. But is it really?
Well, and do you know why it is, why they have the robot arm deal now? Because people are claustrophobic when they get stuck in the regular MRIs.
Oh, sure.
You know, and so this thing, and man, I don't know how much more this thing must cost.
You know,
it's incredible. Do they need I know at least two of them on one floor.
Hmm.
And then on the first floor, they've got all other X-ray stuff, you know, but. And,
it's money not well spent. You know, you can look at every aspect of healthcare where you see where money is spent because it's profit generating. Like, say, the pharmaceutical industry. Come out with a great drug, let's say a statin, which came out about 15, 20, maybe 25 years ago.
Yeah, what do you think about those now?
It can be beneficial, but let me just say this.
Okay.
So, it does help some people. But once one company finds out that another company is going to be making money on it, their interest is to make one too.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, well, it takes a couple of $1 billion to bring a drug to market. you know. So they're going to spend a couple billion dollars to produce a medication that's maybe a slightly better than the other one.
And it's really something that you might be able to control well by diet.
Well,
do you think it's overprescribed too?
Well, it's suggested that everybody who has a elevated cholesterol, LDL, triglycerides, going to have to be on something. But answer your question, you know, the strongest treatment we have in healthcare is the relationship between provider of care and the consumer of care, the doctor and the patient, the strongest relationship. Within this system, because with different institutions that decrease the number of providers that we have available, doctors are seeing people every 10, 15 minutes. So a doctor does not have enough time to engage and listen to the patient. Sometimes all you have to do is listen, touch a patient, and they feel better. And sometimes that's all you need to do. Other than immediately hand a person a prescription for Xanax and say next, or hand a person a prescription for Xanax and Risperdal, and then here's another order for some tests to do, or whatever. Right. Things that probably if you took time and listened to that person, you mean maybe half hour, 45 minutes. And that was one of the benefits I really enjoyed working at Francis Nelson. I was allowed to spend time and have a person come back. You'd tell them, I want you to come back in a week or two, not 6 months or a year from now.
Right.
So you have them come back, and then you can really instruct, and they can they have a little bit more faith in you because they know you care. And that's really the essence of healthcare, is care, is believing that the person who's taking care of you cares about you and not about something else.
If the caller wants to get a call on the air here, they should call 359-5483 real quick. We'll try and get you on the air.
Yeah, and I do, something that I've noticed, and it's probably just because of the particular friends that I happen to end up with, that the mental health is really abusive on that. I mean, I know people who have problems, and they have a regular appointment with a psychiatrist, but that appointment is only to get prescriptions filled, you know, refilled.
Drug checks. Right. Cognitive behavioral therapy, or sitting down and listening, like they talk about Freud, doing all these kind of things where you really get this person to uncover their illness, realize the illness, and do something to adjust their behavior rather than handing them a drug and making them better. I remember those stories, I think it was Brave New World
Soma.
I need some Soma, man.
Yes.
Hello, caller, you there?
Hello.
Yeah. Hi.
Yes?
I've been a nurse in Champaign for over 30 years.
Yeah.
And
you probably know
I wanted
me
to
then.
Comment. Doctor is, I think he's right on about what's going on as far as not enough time, all about money in the medical area. What's going on right now, I'd like to bring to attention of our community, is why isn't there any PPD and why isn't everyone testing? And I believe it has to do with the pharmaceutical companies are not making enough money placing TB tests.
And treatment. You're right.
Exactly.
There's no money. There's lots of drugs because they're so cheap, they're not being made anymore.
Uh-huh.
So we don't have them available to us when they worked before. Hmm. You know,
well,
I see that.
You know that